the Year is... And this ACM Song of the Year is...
For Album of the Year, Traveler, Chris Stapleton.
Chris Stapleton. Nobody to blame, Chris Stapleton.
Unbelievable. Garth Brooks just gave me an award from Iowa, I think. I want to thank my wife. I want to thank everybody who's worked on this record, all the musicians and all the PR folks and all the folks at the label. Everybody's worked so hard, and I want to thank everybody here for treating this record so kindly.
And that was Chris Stapleton. He just ripped it up at the CMA Awards. And I think the country's been waiting for an authentic artist like this, and Adele, and the types of folks who are coming up now, just great musicians, whatever you think about categories of music. This is just music, man. It's just good. And we love music here at Our American Stories. And so for this half hour, we're going to talk about Chris Stapleton. His life a little bit, but in the end, his music. And we know he grew up in Kentucky, born in Lexington, spent his time in a small town called Staffordsville. And he graduated from Johnson Central High. We're going to learn a little bit later. He's a pretty smart guy. He ended up going to Vanderbilt University and studying engineering, of all things. And luckily for all of us, he dropped out. And that doesn't mean the world doesn't need engineers. But what the world really needed was a Chris Stapleton record. I know I can't drive more than an hour right now without listening to it. He channels, I think, what, Dwayne Allman and Bob Seger and B.B. King. It's what all I can think of. He has the lyricism of Seger. And lyrics of Seger's are just some of the best. And, man, his singing, you just hear Dwayne. I just hear it coming through. And that's why he sounds so familiar to people, because he sort of is familiar. And the second you hear him, you go, I've heard this guy before. And even though you hadn't, you had. And there was a piece done on CBS Sunday Morning, and we learned a little bit about Stapleton. And here he is talking about all the songs he's written for other people because he's been around a long time.
I'm new to a lot of people, and that's true. I'm not new to a lot of people in Nashville. They're like, man, I've known that guy for years. He's been bugging everybody.
Anytime somebody sings one of your songs, it's cool.
Very cool. Extremely cool. Like, I think it's the highest compliment.
Any idea how many of your songs other people have cut over the years?
Probably pushing 200, something like that. I don't know.
It's a lot of songs.
It's a lot of songs, yeah. So, but I've written a lot of songs, too. Like, I don't know, I think close to 1,000 or more.
1,000 songs. So the reason you don't hear about this guy in a clinic somewhere is because he's been a journeyman pro for so long that now that he's getting all this success, he's just not going to abuse it. Chris talks about his quick success after moving to Nashville and the jobs he did before that.
I didn't know they would pay you money to sit in a room and write songs for other people. I always thought that George Strait was singing a song, he made it up, and that was the end of it, you know. But the instant I found that out, that could be a job, I was like, well, that's the job for me. I got to figure out how to do that. You know, I moved to Nashville, and 4 days later I had a publishing deal, so which is not, that is not anybody's story, but that's mine. So
it's a good story to have.
It's a good story. I did all of my starving artist things not in Nashville.
So. Like?
You ever had somebody stick a pizza coupon on your windshield in a parking lot? I did that. I sold cars. I was a car salesman.
Were you really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep. And he learned to write out of town. By the way, some of the actors I knew who came to New York who had been at the Guthrie Theater or the Arena stage and had really, you know, sort of gotten their professional chops out of town were able to come in their late 20s with real chops, with a real knowledge of what being a working actor is. The people who came at 19 out of college, oh my goodness, pity them. I mean, they just weren't ready. They were going to get eaten up. Chris says he did what he wanted on this last album because he had had one before, and the way it was produced, the way it was put together, it just didn't do that well. And so on this record, The Traveler, he recorded it and did it his way.
Yeah, I thought this might be the last record I ever got to make. So I'm just like, I'm just going to do whatever I want to.
I'm just a traveler on this earth. Shine my heart behind the pocket of my shirt.
And what you're hearing back there is this remarkable harmony. And I think that Morgan Stapleton may be as good, and I say this with no reluctance whatsoever, may be as good a background vocalist as Emmylou Harris. And I think she has a lot of the same properties and the same concentration and focus that Emmylou has whenever she sings with anybody. And so we hear from his wife, his bride, his love, Morgan Stapleton herself, who says she is still very much smitten with Chris. And by the way, you can see it when they're on the stage. And that she can't believe it took so long for him to become famous.
Back in the day when you were smitten with him, waiting for him to notice you.
For the record, I am still very smitten.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. But did you imagine a day when so many people would also be smitten with him?
Yeah, I can't believe it took so long.
You always thought this day would come?
Yeah, always.
She has an unwavering belief in me that I don't even have, so it really helps. She has enough belief for both of us.
And boy, that really helps no matter who you are, to have that kind of partner who believes in you more than you do. And as an artist, oh my goodness, you can't survive without that. Because sooner or later, people won't like Chris Stapleton. And he will become yesterday's music until he becomes discovered again. Look, we did that hour on Johnny Cash. Star, not a star, star again, not a star, star again. You need some love in your life to be able to handle that. I want to go out right now with a cover that the Stapletons did together at the Grand Ole Opry. And it just shows you the power of their singing and how two becomes, well, just something so special. It's Bob McDill's Amanda. Take a listen as we go out.
I've held it all in. God knows I've tried. It's an awful way country boy's life. Look in the mirror in total surprise. Have the hair on my shoulders and the age in my eyes. Amanda, light of my life. Fate should have made you a gentleman's wife. Amanda.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and you're listening to Chris Stapleton and his wife covering Folsom Prison. And for the rest of this segment, you're just going to be hearing from Chris Stapleton, as he should be heard, singing and playing. And so let's start cutting through some of the music, but before we do, two more insights into the man. Here's an interview we stumbled upon, where Chris reluctantly talks about his life in high school, how uncool he was, and a little tidbit you just wouldn't have imagined from a guy who's this talented with an axe and songwriting.
You went home, played some hometown shows. You did get to go home again. They say you can't go home again, but you made it happen. Was that weird or cool?
Both. It's weird and cool, you know, because there's guys you went to high school with or anything, and I don't know, it's just... They know you when you weren't cool, and you're still not. But everybody else thinks you might be, you know. So
okay, so you brought it up. What was the most uncool thing about you in high school?
Everything about me was uncool in high school, but that's okay.
I can't believe that. I can't believe that at all. Were you marching band? What was your gig?
I played sports, and I got good grades. I was pretty straight laced back then.
Okay. All right. Yeah, because you're valedictorian, right?
Yes. Guilty.
Smart and talented. We love that.
Yeah. Uncool. How many of us felt uncool in high school? Raise your hands, please. That's just about everybody. And so let's take a listen to some of the songs he's written for others. My sister's a songwriter, so she's been sending me Chris Stapleton songs for a long time and saying, I don't want to write anymore. That's how good he is. And everybody from Adele to Tim McGraw, I mean, you just can't, you can go on and on. The type, and what a different type of singer Adele is than Tim McGraw. So what writing chops. But this is him at an ASCAP expo. And ASCAP is a collection of royalties agency that basically makes money for songwriters and collects money from bars and record labels and everybody else so that the writer can get rewarded. And they have expos from time to time where writers perform for other writers. And it's just wonderful. I mean, I think it's sustenance for writers, these expos. And they just honor each other. Here's him, here's Chris Stapleton singing Whiskey and You.
But I do have some drinking songs.
Now we're talking.
And this is one that was on a Tim McGraw record. There's a bottle on a dresser by your ring, and it's empty. So right now I don't feel a thing, and I'll be hurting when I wake up on the floor. But I'll be over it by noon. That's the difference between whiskey and you. Come tomorrow, I can walk in any store. It ain't a problem. They'll always sell me more. But your forgiveness, well, that's something I can't buy. There ain't a thing that I can do. That's the difference between whiskey and you. One's a devil, one keeps driving me insane. At times I wonder if they ain't both the same, but one's a liar. It helps to hide me from my pain, and one's a long gone bitter truth. That's the difference between whiskey and you.
Wow. Straight to the heart. What a storyteller in the end. Let's take a listen to another. This Adele recorded. If it hadn't been for love, this too at a Sundance ASCAP Music Showcase.
This is a song I wrote, if any of you, about the 21 album, the Adele album, over in Europe, which I know a lot of you did. This was on it. Never would have hitchhiked to Birmingham if it hadn't been for love. Never would have caught the train to Louisiana if it hadn't been for love. Never would have run through the blinding rain without $1 to my name if it hadn't been, if it hadn't been for love. Never would have seen the trouble that I'm in if it hadn't been.
And then in 2013, Stapleton took a run at his own record. And, well, I don't think he was completely happy with the way the record was put together, particularly the way it was recorded. But boy, the songwriting was there. And I think you'll get a lot of people picking this record up. My favorite from this record, and my wife introduced me to this one, What Are You Listening To?
put that record on. Girl, you know what's on, and I let it play again and again. You're in every line, takes me back in time. Yeah, tonight I'm wondering, what are you listening to? Is it a cover band in some college town bar where it's 9 hours and their guitars? Or is it something to get you through? Just a sad song playing on the radio station. Tears still falling, heart still breaking, cause you're hanging on. Or is it a love song about someone new? What are you listening to?
And I'll never forget, she wrote me, she goes, listen to that line. Is it a cover band in some college bar where it's na-na-nas and air guitars? And I just went, she went, damn it, I want to write that. It's not fair. And now we get to The Traveler, which I think is just a masterwork. And let's take a listen to Tennessee Whiskey. This is Lee Habib, the work of Chris Stapleton. Google him and Justin Timberlake doing this. A little bit of Nashville, a little bit of Memphis. The horns come in, a little bit of Stax, too. More from Chris Stapleton as we go out.
Found the bottom of the bottle's always dry.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. You're listening to Kurt Cobain, Nirvana Unplugged, back when MTV was deeply relevant to anybody who loved music. Not for the music videos, per se, but these unplugs were sensational. For anybody who had an opinion about some of the bands of the time, unplugging them made you listen to them. And that included Tony Bennett, Springsteen, Stone Temple Pilots, Eric Clapton, you name it. Across every idiom, people started to say, wow, I didn't like that guy before or girl. Now I do, because I can actually hear them. I get it. And we did a story about Kurt Cobain not long ago, about his heroin addiction, about his life, about art and artists particularly and their susceptibility to drug addiction, the nature of their lives. Artists in particular, I have a songwriter sister. I always worried about her because the life is filled with rejection and it never stops even when you make it. And Kurt Cobain was dealing with all kinds of pain and tragedy and a deeply troubled marriage and a troubled woman named Courtney Love. And That leads us to a segment we're about to do right now, brought to you by LifeZet.com, a letter to my heroin addict daughter. And it was written by an anonymous mother who lives in Wisconsin, who we asked to record her story for us. And given that so many Americans are touched by the scourge of drug addiction, alcohol addiction, pills, you name it, we thought this was relevant. And here you go.
Dear daughter, I have lost you. Gone is the baby girl I held in my arms while whispering words of adoration. Gone is the little girl whose fingernails I painted a soft, innocent pink while we sang, I love you, you love me. Gone for now are the dreams I had for your life as I watched you walk into your kindergarten room on that first day of school. Dashed are the hopes that swelled up in my heart when I saw you sing in your school's choral concerts, as you went out on your first date, as you walked down the aisle with your high school diploma in hand. How could I fathom I was watching you march toward the devastation called addiction? I shared in your excitement as you, with a gleam in your eyes, told me about the man that wanted to date you. This could be the one, Mom, you said. He was the one who injected a vein in your arm with your first dose of heroin. How many times he did after that, I don't know, but you were hooked. You eventually overdosed and even once clinically died. In a twisted sense of irony, he was there to resuscitate you. I'll never forget the call I got from the hospital late at night. You were there recovering, but they released you before I arrived. You ran back into his arms, and you both ran, and I began the mad search for my daughter, who had suddenly become a stranger to me. Shock turned into denial, which evolved into anger, and then unimaginable sadness and loss. My little girl was gone. The night you overdosed, I started looking for you at your house. I let myself in, only to find the police had been there before me. I saw papers strewn around your floor, drawers wide open, and your favorite childhood stuffed animal lying abandoned on the kitchen floor. Clutching it to my chest, I sobbed and slowly walked through every room. Your bedroom, where all the drugs were found, was cold. A window was open, and the frigid January wind was seeping in. Where are you? I sobbed as I left. Life would never be the same. We soon discovered it wasn't just heroin. You relied on meth and prescription pills to numb your insecurities and life's pain. I thought I could fix it all. I thought it would be simple. I had no idea what our family was up against. I eventually found you and managed to get you into treatment, thinking 6 weeks in rehab would bring you back. But I was wrong. You always went back to him, back to the needles, spoons, fine white powder, and brown liquid in your veins. The battle to get you back is far from over. It's clear to see how much the drugs have altered your old persona and brain, and I'm now dealing with a new person. Your family and friends have seen you lose weight as your health deteriorates, your body unbelievingly still functioning despite all you're doing to destroy it. We've seen you turn into a liar and a master manipulator. You've learned how to twist and turn facts and situations to where we are hanging on to the string of hope you dangle in front of us. In the beginning, we gave you money, bailed you out of drug-induced debt, gave you rides, always giving you the benefit of the doubt because we thought you were on the road to recovery. We later learned that what we were doing was called enabling. We've talked to you through jail phones with a glass partition between us. We've seen you stand in front of a judge multiple times, taking his lenient sentences. You promised you'd never go back to the drugs again. You snowballed even him. In the beginning, losing you consumed all of us. We cried every day. We couldn't put in a productive day at work. At first, our coworkers showed us sympathy and understanding, but as time wore on, even they got tired of the long journey, saying you belonged in jail. We went to support groups, but found that sharing our sorrow didn't change anything. Losing you to the drugs has been like experiencing a death. The grief has been overwhelming. I tell you this, but you look at me expressionless, worried about your next hit. If I could sit by you while you're using, I would tell you what each syringe does. This dose will send your mother into despair and fits of sobbing. Your next hit will throw your father to his knees as he cries out in pain, "What did I do wrong?" the next will saturate your little brother's pillows with tears of anguish, fear, and disappointment. And the next will rock your little sister's world as her young brain tries to comprehend the concept of addiction. You've lost your license, your car, your house, and friends. When I do get to see you, I hold you and close my eyes as I give you a kiss. For a few seconds, I feel like I'm once again kissing my little girl's smooth, soft cheek, and there is hope. But when I let go, I look into an addict's eyes, and we both know it's all changed. I don't know where it will go from here. I see you taking promising steps forward, then leaps backward. Our family's shock and sorrow have evolved into a fight to keep you off the streets and breathing. We have been dealt a devastating hand that we will never understand. But until the day I die, I will fight to get you back and live the life I dreamed for you as you were growing up. I love you. You love me. Forever, my baby, you'll be.
And that came from Life Zet. And by the way, though you've heard a lot of bad talk if you're watching some of the political goings on, there were two moments of clarity. Carly Fiorina had discussed the loss of her child to drug addiction, and Ted Cruz, the loss of a family member to drug addiction as well. And I did, and I think many people listening have had people in their families. Ours, we didn't know she was addicted to pills. She was. She just found herself in a deep depression, and one day she put a gun to her head. And that was that. Didn't put the family through any ordeal, kept it hidden, felt the shame, and one day she just said goodbye. And so we're going to do these segments. They're hard, but they're important. Neil Young wrote about the addiction that took the lives of so many of his friends back when it was cool to do drugs in the Woodstock and psychedelic era. And so we'll leave with his song, The Needle and the Damage Done.
I caught you knocking at my cellar door. I love you, baby, can I have some more? Oh, the damage done. I hit the city and I lost my band. I watched the needle take another man. Gone, gone, the damage done. I sing the song because I love the man. I know that some of you won't understand. Milk, blood, to keep from running out.
How much is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggly tail. How much
is this is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we cover every topic you can imagine. Love, death, sports, art. I just listened to the Andy Grove piece we'd done. What a life this man led, leading Intel, leading the microprocessor and microchip revolution, and lowering the cost of everything and making it faster and better and ushering in, well, everything we use practically that we love in terms of technology Andy Grove used. Go to ouramericannetwork.org. Read that. Watch it. Listen to it. It's terrific. And we're playing this music because it's time for our The Burning Question segment, which we do each week with the Wall Street Journal's Heidi Mitchell. And The Burning Question at the Journal, with those great journalists and those deep thinkers and those incredible writers and these well-trained, seasoned veteran journalists, is, can kissing your dog make you sick? And I got to tell you, I can't wait to hear the answer to this one, Heidi. Thanks for joining us.
Important journalism being done on kissing your dog.
Let me tell you why it's important, Heidi. I'll tell you a story. I'm away at my family farm. We do this every few weeks, and we get together with cousins and relatives, and we just do nothing. There's not even cell coverage at this farm in the middle of Mississippi. And I'm watching my little pug go out into the stable where the horses are, And he sleeps with us every night. And he started to eat the horse poop. You smell what I'm cooking, Heidi? So let's talk about this, because this is an important question. How did you get to this, by the way? How did you get to this question this week? Why this question?
Well, this was one of those questions that someone in the office asked because she loves her dog and she lets the dog kiss her all over the place. But, you know, we live in the city, most of us, and so there's a lot of icky stuff that the dogs are picking up. But I have to say, it's only like 6% of dogs eat bears or other animal species. So it's not so rare what your dog's doing in the barn there.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
I don't feel so alone. So tell me, what's going on inside that dog's mouth? I mean, I've always heard the dog's mouth is the cleanest place in the world. They have special bacteria, and no matter what they eat, all's just dandy. Talk about that.
Well, the thing is that their mouths are special. You know, they've evolved with all this yucky stuff in there, and it doesn't make them sick for the most part, right? I mean, most dogs are pretty healthy, happy, yep, loving animals and part of the family. And what they carry in their saliva is a lot of bugs. They carry a lot of stuff in there. There's some stuff that isn't going to be harmful to humans. There's some stuff that isn't going to be harmful to them. And then there's the stuff that ain't so great. And those are the things that doctors worry about.
Yeah, I can imagine. So you talked to someone named Dr. Sykes, the interim director of the Veterinary Medical Teaching Hospital at UC Davis. And this is where the journalism comes in, because you've got this burning question that may seem silly, but it leads you down some pretty interesting paths. So what do you learn about...
Oh, it's amazing, because there's experts in everything.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
They devote their whole lives to studying these things.
Well, it's good to know that this doesn't make our dog sick, but the question becomes, does it make us sick? So what does he have to tell us, Dr. Sykes, about your burning question?
So it's a she, but she has lots to say about it. So the most crucial things you need to think about are Campylobacter, which is a food poisoning agent, Giardia, which can cause diarrhea, you probably heard of Giardia, and Salmonella, which is, you know, an organism that affects the gut and makes you have to take a couple days off work or at least not be in public for very long. And all those are just stomach ailments. They're really probably not going to kill you. They might cause dehydration and lots of diarrhea and pain in the gut. But if your dog is licking you all over your face and getting that saliva in your mouth, you know, you can catch that stuff. But it can get worse than that, which is, I can't even pronounce these words, but Capnocytophagia canimorsis and Pastorella multisoda. And those are, they can get into your bloodstream, and they can even cause, occasionally, meningitis, which can kill you.
Yeah, that's not good. And so basically he's saying, if you're going to kiss the dog or let the dog kiss you, not on the mouth, and leave open wounds alone and don't let the hound your wound, basically.
So this is something totally disgusting to me, because she spent a lot of time speaking to me about not letting your dog lick your open wounds. And I was shocked that people would even do that. I mean, I guess if it's a little scratch, maybe you're like, oh, that kind of feels good. But an open gaping wound just sounds totally disgusting. And if you look on the comments on the page that we posted it on the journal, a lot of people talk about their dogs licking their open wounds, that, you know, it'll cure it and help it heal faster. I mean, it's not going to help. It's an open wound, and then you're filling it with all these bacteria that you're already trying to fight an infection, and then there's all the stuff that's coming in, bacteria and little organisms. Not such a smart idea to have your dog lick your open wound.
No, no, that's super yuck. Let me ask you about this, because there are other ways for this saliva to get to us, and I did not think about this, but it's not just kissing the wound or kissing the mouth. It's that catch ball that we
really
play
where
with.
It gets worse, right? Because what do most people do? They play catch with their dogs. So they pick up that juicy tennis ball covered in slobber, and they throw it. The dog catches it, picks it up with its slobbery mouth, brings it back, fetch again. And then, you know, your hands are covered in slobber. And then, you know, people wipe their face something like 60 times an hour, you know, so you're getting it in your eyes and your nose and your ears and your mouth. It's all that slobber is going somewhere into your body. So, you know, you should maybe carry some Purell or wash your hands after, or just try to be cautious of wiping your face when you're playing with your dog.
Yep. And you know, one thing I wanted to ask you is, you write in your piece about, well, getting infected by your canine. I mean, ultimately this can happen, as you were just describing in the piece. What do you do if you are infected by your canine?
funny because most people would think, well, you call your vet because your dog got you sick, so your dog must be sick, but your vet really can't treat a human.
Right.
And she said that there's a lot of, it's like 50-50 people think, I call my doctor, I call my dog's doctor, but you really need to call your doctor. So your doctor's the only one that can prescribe antibiotics or whatever needs to be done to get rid of these bugs in your body that you got from your dog.
You know, you have a couple of some comments, obviously, and the joys of modern journalism is doing anything in public is that you're going to hear from folks. And one person, George Ann Mark Miller, wrote, "Canine blaming is bigotry. The authors are people privileged. Don't need no vet splaining." Ouch. So for the people who think you're hating on the pups, what do you got to say for yourself? You got some explaining to do.
Well, first of all, you got to never read those comments if you write these columns because they're all filled with, I don't know, these people have a lot of time on their hands.
I know.
And they always say mean things. But there are people who are, I'm sure, loving up their dogs and sleeping with their dogs. And, you know, they are part of their family. And I get that. I'm not a dog owner myself, but I get they love their dogs and nobody likes to hear that your dog's carrying germs. But look, my kids are carrying germs too. So I got to wash my hands when they come home too. So
exactly. Exactly.
Everywhere. It's everywhere, right?
Yeah. It's what is really strange though, Heidi, is, you know, my wife watched the dog eat the poop and has watched this before and allows this dog to sleep with us and kiss him. If I went out and ate poop, my wife would not let me kiss her. Why the discrimination against the human? This human hating, that's what I want to know, Heidi.
There is the flip side of the coin. Some people do believe, it's called the hygiene hypothesis, that the more exposure you have to yucky, dirty germs, the more your immune system is going to build up.
That's
and
right.
Then not react when it comes in contact with other foreign objects. So, you know, there's research being done on that right now, but it's not conclusive yet. But she might have something there.
She might have something there.
Otherwise healthy. I mean, pretty much what Dr. Sykes worries about is children under 5 and people over 65.
Right.
And also people who are already immunocompromised, like a pregnant woman or, you know, a drug user or someone who cancer. So if you're healthy, you know, you're occasionally getting licked by your dog, even your dog that's eating the poop in the barn, maybe you're going to be okay.
That's right. Hey, let me read you another
maybe don't
one.
Kiss your wife.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. Let me read one from Ian Andrews for you. 5 dogs occupy my bed. 5 dogs kiss me throughout every day, every week of the year. So far, so good. Also, this is my 4th generation of pups. I treat them all the same. They get to kiss me and sleep next to me in bed. They're better than girlfriends or wives as they don't complain about us and any BS. So there you go. You really tapped a nerve with this one, didn't you, Heidi?
Oh, they hate me. They all hate me.
They hate you. Hey, Heidi, when you guys are sitting around, how does this happen? Do you have a consensus? Do you have a group meeting and say that's the one? How does the subject get picked each week?
Sometimes it's just like we're sitting around. Sometimes my husband will email me something from work and be like, oh, I need to know, is a stand-up desk better?
Right.
You know, or I'm driving in the car for 6 hours and I'm like, my back really hurts. Is there a better way to stretch my back? And they're like, that's a great burning question.
Right.
Sometimes they're like, you know, it's getting hot, it's getting cold. Should I worry about my wet hair? You know, so it varies. Sometimes we get emails. Anybody can email in burning@wsj.com. They can mail in their questions and we can have that random question you never thought to ask answered by an expert.
Well, Heidi, I appreciate what you're doing. It's just fun to do this. And I think next week we were discussing this. We're building a pool at our house. And if you remember, there was always that wives' tale. You eat a tuna fish sandwich, you got to wait a half hour. You eat a roast beef sandwich, you got to wait 45 minutes before you can swim. And there was always this one person at the pool who knew exactly how long you had to wait before you could actually go in the pool. I think that may be one of our burning questions. Not that I want to impose on you, but, you know, every once in a while we think these thoughts too. Now, you got us thinking about these things.
When it gets a little bit warmer, we will circle back on that one.
Awesome. Well, Heidi, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it. And come back each week, please.
Thanks, Lee. Take care.
You bet. Enjoy. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. The burning question, can kissing your dog make you sick? And I just keep thinking about my dog in that barn, and that makes me sick just thinking about it. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More after this.
loving him. Then Sue came along, loved me strong, that's what I thought. Me and Sue, but I do.
Why are we playing this again?
We are playing this because this is awesome. The music. This is the music segment where we disagree about everything, as anybody will do when they talk about their most privately and closely held musical passions. And this is one of mine. I love Neil Diamond, and people look at me funny when I say that, as Jesse is right now. He's mortified.
I thought you didn't like it. That's why we're going to come in and kind of laugh at it.
No, I actually love Solitary Man.
Oh, my gosh.
And I hate Coming to America.
Huh. That's interesting.
Now, I don't like the production of this, because this was laced in the 60s. But when you strip it down, it's a great song. And that's what what's always fun about music is, you know, Elvis can be great. Then Elvis is in the Suecoon jumpsuit, and he sounds crazy. And depending on where you enter Elvis's life, you'll look at another guy and go, what were you thinking? And this was, I think, the case with Neil Diamond. And so we were having a random discussion about music, about, well, Hengler's obsession with Dave Matthews. It's rather strange. He says he's had religious epiphanies at Dave Matthews concerts.
Everyone out there is saying, Lee's strange for feeling that way, because it's normal.
It's normal. And Jesse just doesn't understand any of it because he doesn't get Dave Matthews. And all he does when you say Dave Matthews is he does that famous Jesse grunt. That's it. You're not going to hear another word from him. And we're not sure what Alex likes, because he loves Creed and then says, I'm sorry, right after he says it.
Everybody's got those guilty pleasures. They just,
it's true. What's yours, Ed? We don't know your guilty pleasures. Come clean. Now come clean. You've got one.
Spice Girls?
Spice Girls, come
you know
on.
What? You know what? You're getting closer. I'm trying to figure it out. I like Taylor Swift. I would never buy her albums, but I think she's talented and a good role model, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. That's probably okay, but that's not so terrible. You know. That's not so terrible. I mean, Ryan Adams just recorded that Taylor Swift record, and he's cool. So, she's sort of kind of cool, and you got kids, too.
Yeah,
so,
I just can't think of too much crap that I actually do enjoy. But
yeah.
That doesn't even make sense.
Well, no, what he's saying is that we actually enjoy garbage, but he can't.
You have to be aware of what other people think of it. It's not you consider it crap. Like for me, right. I know other people consider Air Supply to suck. I like Air Supply.
Oh, that's painful.
Making right. love out of nothing at all? That's great. It's Stadium Rock.
Stadium Rock.
It's 2 a.m. I'm drunk again. It's heavy on my mind.
Stop mumbling, Dave. Stop mumbling. That's nice, though.
Hey, look, we have our favorite concerts and we have our worst concert experiences. And so that's what we really have to dig into here. And worst concert experience, Edwards. You're revved up to see the show.
Oh, man.
And they come out and they just
stink.
That was
easy. Peter Frampton was the worst show I think I've ever seen in my life.
And why?
Not only was it just sounding out of key, and it was just boring, and his opening act, who was Buddy Guy, was 10 times more talented than he was.
Of course.
He before his set, he came out and whined at the audience not to take his picture. Because the show previously, I forget where it was, somebody was taking his picture, he told him to stop, and the guy kept taking pictures, so the guy ripped his iPhone out of his hand and threw it backstage. It caused a little snuffle in the news. It was in the news.
Ugh. And so he said,
he got up on stage for a half hour and told us why he didn't want people taking his picture.
Oh, that's great. So you're getting lectured at a concert.
Yeah, so I started taking his picture, and his guitar player shaking his head at me. So then my wife and I and the people we were with, we just turned our backs to him and sat there on the lawn with our backs to him doing the whole show.
And everybody takes pictures.
I mean, you spend your entire life trying to be somebody up on a stage and get your image out there and be a rock star, heaven forbid, and somebody's going to take your picture and you're going to whine about it like a little girl.
It's crazy.
I mean, Buddy Guy was amazing.
Oh, yeah,
he was only allowed to play for like a half hour because little prissy boy, Peter Frampton, had to come out there on stage with his sequins pants and those little rivets on it. It was so stupid. And this was an intimate show where it was the Brit Festivals in Oregon, where there's nothing between you and the stage. It's just the
right.
grass and the stage.
Yep.
He had to have these big old metal barriers up there, like these 6 foot tall metal
to protect
things.
Him from you crazy
yeah,
fans.
Yeah, to protect us from this little tiny hippie festival kind of a thing. And it was just man. I'll yeah. never again. Sorry.
Yeah, and by the way, Frampton was this gigantic star.
Yeah.
Frampton Comes Alive was this gigantic record, and he was this sex symbol, and he was in movies, and then he was nobody. which has got to be really painful. Hengel, your worst concert experience, or do you just love all of them?
I was sitting there thinking, like, and yeah, I pretty much did, because I don't commit unless I know, you know, it's going to be good stuff. But I would have to say that the opening band for GNR was Soundgarden, and it was beyond awful.
Guns N' Roses. GNR is, yeah, Guns N' Roses, yeah, for you non-Guns N' Roses fans. GNR. Yeah. S. You didn't say Soundgarden. You should have said S. Oh, yeah, right. Soundgarden. Right. Got it. Mine was Johnny Cash. Biggest disappointment in my life. Wow, I've seen him a couple of times, and he was just terrible. But then I saw him when he was good, and then that was one of the great nights of my life.
And he's your favorite.
He is, but what I'm saying is sometimes you go to see, yeah, your favorite. Led Zeppelin, I mean, I saw them in Madison Square Garden. It was terrible. It was incomprehensibly bad. And then I saw him again two or three years later, and it was incomprehensibly good.
Yeah.
Stevie Ray Vaughan, incomprehensibly bad when he was on drugs. Then I saw him on the Instep tour just before that helicopter crashed and he died. Best show, one of the best shows I've ever seen.
How about a show? How about like a group you didn't like, but then you saw them live and then you liked them instantly?
Oh my goodness. There's a bunch of.
Mine was Metallica. I couldn't stand Metallica. And then I went to a show. I was like, oh, okay, I get it. Now I can't stand them anymore again, but
a lot of the,
such is life.
Some of the country acts, that's what did it. Lone Star Cafe hooked me to George Jones.
Uh-huh.
It got me going. Got me going on a bunch of people. And then the Pink Floyd. I never liked Pink Floyd till I saw him.
Wow.
Yep. And Prince. I didn't like Prince at all till I saw Prince. And Prince may have been the greatest showman I've ever seen in my life. Better than James Brown. And I saw James Brown. And James Brown had nothing over Prince.
Wow.
So, yeah. Wow. What about you gentlemen over there? John, best show.
Best show? Man, what we entered with. Neil Diamond. Just the energy in the stadium.
A wise man.
I mean, that was... It was amazing. If the whole crowd together singing every song, I mean, it was amazing. Worst concert?
Yeah.
Pretty easy. It was Paul Simon and Bob Dylan together.
Oh, wow.
And Dylan was horrible. You couldn't even understand what he was saying. Paul Simon, on the other hand, good show, but yeah, they were playing together, and it was amazing.
That's rough. And we're going to go out with some Neil Diamond, just for Jesse. Just
yay,
for Jesse. And Alex, the You Love Creed, we need to say no more. I will have to leave on that note. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Just goofing off here for a segment, just like you do so often in your life. More after these messages. The solitary
man. Solitary man. Those horns sound like flatulence.
This is Lee Habib, and this is our final thought segment, and we'll be using this Brian Eno music each time. It's a story about someone who's recently passed, a eulogy. And by the way, this music called An Ending or Ascent, you can hear this at the World War II Museum in the Road to Tokyo exhibit, in the final exhibit. And it's when we get to see the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. We actually understand why, after walking through that exhibit, why our men had to do that. And as the mushroom cloud rises, this music, composed specifically for that museum by Eno, a great composer, comes up. And not a dry eye leaves that exhibit. Do go to New Orleans when you get a chance, the World War II Museum. And now we're going to bring you this week's final thoughts. And the feature is a eulogy delivered by Deal Hudson for his sister Ruth Ann, who had recently passed at 69 years of age and was survived by their mother. Let's take a listen.
I think our families have met before.
I think at weddings, Jennifer and Seeley's. Isn't it wonderful we all look the same? I didn't really come with any prepared remarks, except to say to all of you who are here, thank you. Thank you for being here. It is an honor that you're showing to my sister and to our entire family, who join me in saying thank you. Instead of a eulogy, I would rather read you a letter from my sister Ruth, whose words will mean so much more to you than anything I can say, and more to me. Here's her letter. Dear brother, when I asked you to give a eulogy at my funeral, I knew you would find the right words to say. After all, you were always so good at talking yourself out of any kind of trouble. Well, most trouble. But I knew you would first look at our mother's face, Emmy, and you would say, I love you, Mom. I loved you when I was with you, and I love you now from where I am now. I love you even more because I am now standing close to Love himself, the one whose very being is love, nothing else. And here I'm perfectly happy, no longer struggling for breath, because the very breath of life has been breathed into me once again. I am reborn. You always said a mother should never live to see her child die. I understand why you said that. You said that because I would have been crushed myself if Jennifer or Seeley had passed before me. But now, where I am, I have the advantage of telling you, try not to grieve too much or too long, because I'm not really gone from you. With the eyes of faith, you can see me clearly, as I can see you, and pray for you, all of you, without ceasing. Life here is kind of like an endless prayer for those we love and even those we don't know. When we meet again, you will understand why I have written this letter to you, for you to hear and to believe. Brother, I know how much you hate talking about yourself, which is one of the reasons I decided to write you, so that you wouldn't have to struggle for the words to describe how much you'll miss me and so forth. Rather than that, I would like to tell you, like you to tell everyone, how I always asked you to sing The Impossible Dream whenever we were together.
To write the unrightable wrong, to be better far than you are, to try when your arms are too weary.
It was kind of family tradition going back to high school days. I have to tell you, brother, it wasn't because you have such a great voice. No, what I loved was the deal you became when you were singing. How you showed your heart. How you came out from behind your mind and all those books you are always reading. When you sang to me, I felt you open and give me the brotherly love you sometimes felt it difficult to give. And to your credit, you never, not even once, refuse to sing. Please, please, brother, keep singing. Be that man. She writes, I always found it hard to say goodbye to my friends. They will remember how I always begged them to stay with me a little longer. Please tell them, and I wish I could speak to each of them by name. Please tell them how they enriched my life beyond measure. In fact, their friendship, coupled with my family's love, surely extended my life by many years. It was knowing all of you were there, as you are now, the pull of your love that pulled me into the future. Enjoying years I might not have had otherwise. To them, say thank you for my life, for the fullness of that life and those years they gave me. Just as I found it hard to say goodbye, it's hard to bring this letter to an end. The last letter I will ever write. Though it's my last letter, not my last thought, word, or prayer. Those will cross that invisible line between eternity and time and descend as a blessing upon all of you. When I lived among you like everyone, I had my doubts. Here, there are no doubts. Here we see face to face. I know that my prayers will help fill the void you feel and lessen the pain. Truly, your prayers and mine have already met. Met at that invisible line where everything turns into glory. Ruth.
To dream the impossible dream, to fight the unbeatable foe, to bear with unbearable sorrow.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. Final thoughts. Deal Hudson. His late sister, Ruth Ann. Love the part where he said, when we sang to me, you gave me the brotherly love you found difficult to otherwise give. That reminded me of Aquinas, who always said, when we sing, we pray twice. Please, brother, she said, keep singing. Be that man. This is Lee Habib. Final thoughts. Our American Stories. More after this.
This is my quest to follow that star, no matter how hopeless, no matter how far, to be willing to give.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. A few weeks back, we had on the show Will Avila, the co-owner of Clean Decisions, a business that provides professional-grade cleaning for commercial kitchens and food trucks, and a business created by Avila, a former prisoner, to help other former prisoners like him successfully re-enter society. Abandoned by his mother and left with an alcoholic father, Will ended up in prison, and when he came out, he couldn't find work, as is the case with many former felons. And he landed in prison again and again. Will finally landed a job at a Chipotle where his friend told him he didn't have to check the criminal box when applying. And he landed on the idea to do some more sustainable things for former felons.
especially their reentry into the workforce. And here on Our American Stories, there's no story we don't tell. And we're interested in all American lives. And there are a whole lot of American families who are tied up with folks who are involved in what some people call the prison industrial complex, but I don't like to go that far. But there are some real problems with our prisons, and it particularly as it relates to what do we do with people who serve their time and now want to reenter this civilian life and live a normal life. And like most things in life, rarely is one person's story just theirs. It's also the story of those who weren't there for them and those who were there for them. And for Will, that person was and still is Graham McLaughlin, whose story we want to dive in today along with Will. Graham and Will, thank you, both of you, so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, look, before we get into anything serious, I just want to say sorry for your loss, Graham. So sorry for what happened to UNC last night.
Oh, man, tough.
Very tough.
Well, I would say it was a tough defeat, but when we're talking about these types of issues, it is a very small thing in the grand scheme.
It is. And, you know, I'm an ACC guy. I went to University of Virginia, so I'm always rooting for any team in the ACC and any program that has Dean Smith as its real, real founding mentor. And I think there's very few men like Dean Smith who is a mentor to so many men. We'll be doing an hour on his life soon. And that leads us to you and Will in the end. Graham, tell us about your childhood and where you got your sense of purpose in life.
Yeah, well, my childhood was much different than Will's. I was raised by two parents who really set me up with a positive infrastructure of love, of support, of just great models. I get my purpose through my faith. Will and I are of different faiths, but we both believe in the same God, and I think are both men of deep faith and feel a sense of purpose and meaning through that. And so for me, it is the sense of the transformative love I feel from God and how I am able to manifest that in my own daily actions just because I feel so grateful every day.
Well, and Graham, we find that out often in this world. We spend a lot of time on our show. We just did an hour on Martin Luther King, and we learned where he found his love of man, and particularly his love of the white people who treated him so poorly. And he admonished his fellow African Americans and urged them and begged them and led by example to love his fellow man and his brothers, even those who treated him poorly. But you were not born to faith or weren't of faith early. What happened to bring you to faith, Graham?
It wasn't an epiphany or anything specific like that. I mean, I did have good models of faith in parents and other folks, but it was really just across my 20s, the feeling like, you know, what am I doing with life? There has to be something more in the sense that I'm in a good job, have some good friends, have fun, go out and everything else. But there's just a lack of that meaning and that gnawing at me and that feeling a little bit of emptiness. And as I kind of search to fill that emptiness, but also just the human condition of being pulled towards justice and being pulled towards meaning and what's the purpose in life and is there anything else out there, I came to God. And the more I looked at the Bible, the more I was kind of counseled by people who were further in their spiritual journey than me, I just saw the truth and the peace and the serenity and the strength that one gets when they believe in God, whether that is through the Christian faith, through Islam or through other faiths, but when they believe in that transformative, loving God that we have.
Yeah, later on, you find yourself working, consulting at a publicly traded advisory board in the Washington, D.C. area, and you then transition into your current job as their managing director of community impact. What was behind that transition? And talk about that if you could.
I've always been interested in how do you leverage the power of business, the power of corporations, the economic and innovative and kind of just broad workforce that they have to drive good. And as part of that, you have to drive consumers towards good, and you have to drive behavior change there. And from an employee standpoint, drive change in the views of employees. And so I was pulled towards CSR because from a government perspective, you can do great good, but it's at a glacial pace. And in a nonprofit, you're doing good at that ground level, but you're always scraping and kind of duct tape and spreadsheets to fix problems. But with corporations, you have resources, you have energy, you have passion, and you have the market behind you. And I was just fascinated by that concept, so really pushed to move into corporate social responsibility.
You know, tell me this. I mean, some people argue that the bottom line is that if we don't make profits, we can't have a business. Moreover, some argue, and it's not me, by the way, but I've heard smart people I respect say this, when we deliver a good service and we lower the price of something the way Henry Ford did, he lowered the price of automobiles, and the business itself was performing a great social service, providing a good service in a volunteer transactional marketplace, and you're employing a person and you're paying corporate taxes. So talk about that extra overlay of that added social responsibility and how that can cohabit with the desire for profit. Talk about that, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, all of the points that you say, I agree with in the sense that the way our system is set up, business should be providing a service, should be providing value, and ultimately should be a net positive. But there are areas where, with intentionality, it can provide a greater net positive both to the community and ideally to the business itself. I think environmental responsibility is an area in the past few years that has been focused on by a lot of businesses. You see a reduction in costs on things like packaging, et cetera, so it's good for the bottom line, but it's helping the world. I think when you think about clean decisions, the business Will started, he could have just started a general labor services firm. And in this case, he may have even been able to make a bit more money because he wouldn't have had to invest so much in the development of his workforce, et cetera. But with intentionality, he is making a larger impact on the world while still also making a bottom line benefit. So I think there's two schools of thought on corporate responsibility. One, which is held by the Fortune, call it 25,000, because basically every large corporation, but it's the idea of doing good and doing well and using corporate responsibility to further your own bottom line through employee engagement or through conscious consumerism, whatever it would be. But I think there's this cadre of businesses out there, and Will's an amazing leader with it, where with intentionality, they drive greater good, but they may actually sacrifice to do so. And I think Will's done that with clean decisions.
Well, and I think that's a beautiful explanation. When we come back, we're going to talk to Will Avila, and we're going to talk more with Graham McLaughlin, too. Mentor and mentee, helping returning prisoners into civilian life. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we're joined by Graham McLaughlin and Will Avila, mentor and mentee. And what a story theirs is. And Graham, we just got finished talking about business and how businesses can choose a path. And there are these two paths, and they're both good paths. How did you bump into Will Avila, and what happened next after you bumped into him? Tell that story.
I first met Will at a poetry reading he was doing, and we just kind of talked through his desire to change the path that he was taking, but also provide that opportunity for other returning citizens. And based on that first conversation, we grew into a friendship, and I was able to provide some of the unique differentiators I had in supporting him with business knowledge, et cetera. And he was able to provide some of the unique differentiators that he has from empathetically being able to understand that path, being the incredible manager and reader of people that he is, being a person who can watch a YouTube clip and then put a patio in. And so it was just a really good combination. And I think even the distinction of mentor-mentee, I think in some times I play a mentor role to him and sometimes he plays a mentor role to me. And so it was kind of that first conversation, but led into a number of years of walking together where sometimes one of us takes the lead, sometimes the other takes the lead, and we both kind of learn and grow from each other in different ways.
Yeah, and I think we learn that even the best coaches at some point understand that they're the teachers, but the students sometimes and often are teaching them. I know that as a parent as well. Will, what has Graham meant to you and to your life? Talk about that if you can.
Well, Graham, when I first met Graham, I didn't know what to say. You know, he looked like a responsible guy, and he looked like a corporate guy, and not being able to get out of my surroundings, of always being around a native and the gangs and just violent people, I wanted to make new friends and new and get a mentor. Graham came, and we talked and discussed the hardships of coming out of prison and how it's so hard to stay out of prison and go and get your mindset back into the negative world. And Graham just told me to give it. Basically told me to give a chance to myself. Just let me, let God deal with it and just go from there. And what that meant to me was that, you know, even though he wasn't a part of my upbringing, even though he wasn't a part of what I call my society, he was also an understanding person. And he believed in me after talking with him. He believed in the mission of giving people second chances, third chances, fourth chances. And he believed and he saw in me what many people put me off as a loss to society or a troublesome person to society. He gave me an opportunity to express how I felt about that and help out other people. So he offered me that thought process that a lot of people had given up on and gave me a second chance. And through faith, you know, he expressed how the love of God and forgiveness of God is always there and everybody makes mistakes.
Well, it's so true. And you used a word there that men don't generally use, and that's the word love. Maybe they'll say that to their wife and to their kids, but they don't say that to men they know. And talk about that word, if you can, Will, and what it means to you, and about Graham's love and yours for him, because it sounds like this is a love story, and it's okay to have love stories. The Lonesome Dove is one of my favorite movies. It's a love story. It's okay. Guys can love guys.
You're killing Will Street Cred here. Killing it.
love is a word we find in the Bible and in the Quran. I've been of understanding and reading the book. The love of God is one thing that many people, I believe, sometimes we forget about, and how he presents and puts people in your life to, you know, be able to create, you know, a path for yourself. Graham, you know, is a very good friend of mine and a very great mentor, and the way he, you know, speaks with God in prayer and the way we have prayed, it was very new to me to be able to see other people find that peace. Love is in many forms another a word for peace, because you find yourself through the peace and the prayer, and love is from God, because if you don't love yourself, sometimes you will always fail, and that's what I found out, that I didn't love myself and I couldn't present myself to other people because I didn't forgive myself, and I always resented society back in the day because how I was treated. And the love of God came into my life, and the mentor like Graham came into my life. He put somebody there to, you know, help me along the path.
Well, and you guys are more than business partners. You're roommates. Talk about this, Graham, and what you've done. It's pretty unique, but perhaps it shouldn't be.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, we are no longer roommates because Will has just purchased his own home in trying to create a home for his son and really kind of create that family atmosphere that he maybe wasn't able to have and also provide opportunity for other returning citizens to have safe, stable housing. So we unfortunately aren't anymore, but it was a great, great couple of years when we were. And I mean, it goes a little bit to what I talked about before. It was two friends who had really grown a lot from each other and learned a lot from each other. And, you know, the biblical quote, iron sharpening iron, really is what occurred during that time. But we were also able to give other returning citizens an opportunity to exhibit and have that same safe space, that same family-like atmosphere. And it's something now that we're exponentially able to expand as each of us have an anchor home and hopefully others in our program, Changing Perceptions, being the nonprofit, Clean Decisions, the for-profit, are able to create. So it was a great time in life, and now it's an even better extension of it.
And Graham, what would you say to folks in your position, that is successful business professionals, going about their business, as just some advice to them who are listening? Give some if you can. Share some.
Yeah, so I don't know if this is to successful business professionals or just to everyone in society, but there are unique gifts that each of us have, and we are able to give those gifts freely. And in many cases, it requires sacrifice, but you can drive great good. But also, everyone has unique gifts the other way, in the sense that through institutional racism, through classism, through not seeing people for who they are, we many times lose out on people who can teach us, people who can help us grow into the full humans that we can become, and people who will enrich our lives. And so, you know, my advice would be, feel the transformative love of the divine. Think about how you use the unique gifts and blessings that have been bestowed on you to help others, and receive that love and help from others as well in kind of a give and take setup.
And Will, what would you say to any former prisoners listening today, or anyone in the middle of trouble, or their family members? Talk to them directly if you can.
Yes, I would say, you know, give yourself a shot, you know, give yourself a chance. In many ways, we never do. I found myself always revolving in that door because I never gave myself a chance to, you know, get out of the neighborhood or get out of the block or the mentality of always thinking I'm going to fail and I'm a failure to others and I've let everybody down. And I feel that if we all just, you know, think about it and think about our steps in life and see how many encounter our blessings, instead of keep counting our failures, I think we would achieve many things. And we take for granted what, you know, God has given us sometimes. And we just sit back and relax every now and then and count our blessings. We will see much more to society and be able to give a hug and a handshake to a guy that we don't know, a homeless guy asking for money, or a guy coming down the street in anger and enraged. We don't know what's going on. Or a lady, you know, asking for help for her kids, and we see that, and we see the distraughtness in them, the sadness and the anger. With one smile or with one hello, how are you? You give that person another chance of living at many times. And I feel like if you just sit back and relax and count your blessings instead of counting your failures, there will be so much more to life.
Well, I couldn't hear better words from anybody, Will. Thanks for that, Graham McLaughlin and Will Avila. Thanks for what you've done. Thanks for inspiring the folks who are listening. And Clean Decisions, what a great idea. Men in prison, as you so well put it, Graham, citizens. They're citizens now. And we got to keep them citizens, and we got to keep them straight and give them the love they need to succeed. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More after this.